The Intermediate Court of Appeals is now in session. The Honorable Craig H. Nakamura, Catherine G. Leonard, and Lisa M. Ganoza presiding. Please be seated. Case number CAP 1225, Gore & Pligo, LLC, v. Dragon Riddick, Peter Esser for appellants, cross appellees, Gore & Pligo, LLC, Gore & Pligo, and Anna Maria Pligo, Keith Hirooka for appellees, cross appellants, David W. Lacey, and Lacey & Jackson, LLC, and Robert Klein for appellee, Dragon Riddick. Arguments on the merits.
Morning, counsel. Everyone ready to proceed?
Yes.
Mr. Esser, go ahead.
The thing I just took out of my mouth is a cough drop, and I have a pretty bad bronchitis, so if I cough, I apologize. It'll keep me from making so much noise, so maybe you'll like that. I represent Gorin and Anna Marie Pligo and their LLC, the three plaintiffs. And this is a case involving the purchase of a transportation company on the Big Island, where they were represented by attorney David Lacey. They purchased the company from Dragon Riddick by giving him $378,000 in Las Vegas properties and a $1.2 million promissory note.
Mr. Esser, if you don't mind, who owned the Vegas properties?
They were either in Gorin's name or jointly held by Gorin and Anna Marie.
Is there any evidence in the record that they were jointly held as opposed to held by Gorin?
I don't know that. I don't know. I do know that only Gorin was a member of LLC, and that only Gorin signed the promissory.
But if there's no evidence that Maria owned any of that property, doesn't she have any lack standing to raise claims of damages based upon the fact that property was transferred as part of the purchase?
Where we could look, assuming we were focusing on the motion to dismiss, is the Second Amendment complaint. And so we'd start there because that'd have to be deemed true. So I'd assume it says in there about the ownership of those properties. She is, of course, a party. But it isn't just that investment in the property. It's also the $300,000 in investments that came out of their bank accounts. Now, whether those were joint or Gorin's bank accounts is maybe another question. But their list of damages submitted at the trial was $688,000. And that, of course, was after the payment of the $650,000 by Lacey to rent for dismissing claims. So there's plenty of evidence in terms of the motion to dismiss because we're relying on the Second Amendment complaint.
But now there was affidavits and exhibits attached to submitted to court on the motion to dismiss, weren't there?
I think the court didn't rule
simply on the pleadings, did it?
So then, in other words, the possibility of a 12C judgment on the pleadings type thing. I think there was some reference, and of course, one of the reasons that the court dismissed the conspiracy count against Lacey is because of the ruling against Riddick, which was, of course, not in the Second Amendment complaint, therefore is outside the record. And that's one of the things I argued in my brief, is that it was inappropriate to do that for a number of reasons. Also, the fact that there was nothing in the motion to dismiss asking that the conspiracy be dismissed. But yeah, to the extent that he goes outside the record, I would say, though, that subsection C has some requirements in it. It doesn't just say you can do it willy-nilly. It says if you do it, you have to give the other side a chance to respond. There are plenty of documents attached to the opposition to Renick's motion for summary judgment, of course, and also the motions for partial summary judgment filed later by Lacey. And then, of course, there's the judgment as a matter of law in the trial, which was brought by Lacey and is based on the evidence.
Mr. Esser, if I could,
sure.
You know, for me, what would help clarify? Now, one of the issues before us is whether the settlement was enforceable. The
yes.
Settlement vis-a-vis Riddick Goron Playho and the Playho LLC. There's two settlements, so that settlement enforcement is in question.
Yes, I see your point. Yes.
Right. So I know your point is that it's not enforceable, but if it is enforceable, if we assume that we get past that issue, what was left in terms of the claims to be decided by the court? If you assume those settlements are valid binding settlements,
yes.
And I recognize that they were entered into sort of after orders had been issued on dismissals,
yes,
and SJs, but if they're valid settlements, they're valid settlements, and what is left at that point?
If they're
point?
Valid, then all of the claims by the individual plaintiffs are dismissed. But keep in mind, when you're talking about that settlement, you're only talking about Rennick. You're not talking about Lacey, which is the primary partner's appeal. That's why Lacey's counsel will talk for 25 minutes and Rennick's for 5, because this is really a Lacey appeal. Nevertheless, perhaps the most troubling aspect of the settlement and the arguments that we're most concerned with, or at least I am, is the waiver arguments, the appeal, the so-called binding arbitration statement, sua sponte, made by Judge Ibarra midway through that March 10, 2011 hearing. I've litigated appeals involving reducing oral settlements to judgment in family court where there's a statute or a court rule. There is no analogous court rule in the civil rules, but generally, if you look at the case law, in fact, the case law cited by Rennick, they're all cases where this court or the ICA review, I'm sorry, I just called you the Supreme Court, it must have been that symbol up there, where the appellate courts reviewed them because there was an appeal. So the idea that Judge Ibarra can pipe up with this binding arbitration statement, assuming that's what it is, to me it's vague, but assuming that you interpret it as that, I would just argue, especially since Gordon's not in the room, he's on the telephone and listening from Las Vegas, is not an attorney, and no appeals were discussed at all during the colloquy between Judge Ibarra and Gordon. And more importantly, if you look at the order enforcing the settlement and the proposed order by Rennick, by Quagg, his lawyer, there's nothing in that order saying anything about appeals. So there really is nothing but this sua sponte statement by the judge. Now, it's certainly something. I'm not going to say it's not there. It's there. It's troublesome. But I think clearly there's been no waiver of an appeal, especially, to me, waiving an appeal in a case like this, especially if you look at that.
Mr. Esser, assume that we're with you on that point for the moment. Tell us what other issues there might be with the settlement agreement.
The only other issue is whether the LLC is a guarantor. And clearly they're not. And my primary argument is that...
Well, is it whether they're a guarantor or whether they're co-obligor on the $4,000?
One or the other, something like that. And of course, in the first proposed judgment sent by Claggett, he included Anne Marie and Anna Gore and the next door neighbor. He wanted everybody in there, which was why we call that a counteroffer, which rejects the settlement. Because at the 310 hearing...
But you were at the 310 hearing representing there was a settlement. I mean, I think it was pretty clear that no one is trying to enforce a settlement against Anna Maria and Anna Gore, isn't that correct?
No, at this point they're not. But it is clear what the position that my client has taken is that the only terms of the settlement were those stated by Rostock, period. Nothing else. Not the additional comments. And if you look at those terms, there's no mention in there of waiving an appeal of either the summary judgment motion or some later enforcement of the settlement. In other words, you don't automatically waive an appeal just because you're dropping claims. You clearly don't. And two or three times during the colloquy, Claggett actually acknowledges that the terms are as stated by Rostock, which were handwritten and read from a handwritten document. So it doesn't really matter what those terms were if they don't include a waiver of the appeal. Now, it's true, though, that Claggett made that statement afterwards. He said, oh, this means everything. This means no appeal. The position we've taken, buy it or not, is that that wasn't included in the Rostock handwritten terms.
All right, but putting that aside, other than the question of whether The LLC is liable under $100,000 payment. Is there any other dispute that you have with the terms of the settlement as approved by the court?
No, there isn't, but one other comment needs to be made about the LLC. Claggett acknowledged, not only at that hearing, but also at the subsequent trial when he testified, that the LLC's claims against, Rennick's claims against the LLC and vice versa were gone as a result of the $650,000 payment. There's absolutely no reason for the LLC to participate in the payment of that $100,000, because what's the $100,000 for? It's to compensate Rennick for dismissal of the claims against the individual parties. So there's no logic to it. The only logic he argued later on
But Gorin controls the LLC. Doesn't, if he wants to cut a deal, if Gorin wants to cut a deal to settle the case, why couldn't he, on behalf of the LLC, put the LLC in?
There'd be no reason to, because all of the claims by the LLC have already been removed.
Wait, but Gorin has an interest in settling. So why wouldn't Gorin want to include the LLC if that was necessary to reach the settlement?
Well, he's maybe there's a fiduciary question, I don't know. It seemed to me that if you look at the exact words there, Your Honor, which is what we've been trying to get the courts to do, it doesn't say a word about the LLC. It says Gorin Playhill will execute a promissory note.
That right, but isn't there a prefatory statement before all of the other individual terms saying that Gorin's agreeing to this settlement on behalf of himself and the LLC?
Actually, that's not prefatory. That was in the colloquy with Gorin on the telephone later,
okay.
Page 12.
But he does represent that the terms are on behalf, that he's agreeing on behalf of himself and the LLC.
Sure, and of course, what we argued, if you recall, is that there are terms in the settlement that do involve the LLC, that he can't come by the LLC, which is the RLS, the business. He can't bother them. He can't. There are three or four things above that sentence involving the note.
Right, but when you say he can't bother him, that's Rennick that can't bother
yes.
Them. Right, but that's not the LLC entering
no,
into
no,
agreement
but,
not
but
to bother
the
Rennick.
LLC is mentioned, and all of the LLC terms are above this statement involving the $100,000. Again, the question is, if there is a, terms are stated in the record, and you come back and you have a dispute, the question is, if the judge enforces something by implication, is that the way you're supposed to enforce a settlement?
Do we owe any deference to the trial court's interpretation of this colloquy? I mean, he was there.
No, it's de novo, according to Mijo. Let me move on. I appreciate your concern about that. It's a fascinating issue, but it's such a small part of this appeal because, again, this is a lazy appeal. And my concern, obviously, is this motion to dismiss primarily. And also this, to me, absurd ruling that my individual Playho's clients are not real parties in interest, are not necessary under Rule 19, are not real parties in interest under 17, and are not permissive joinder under 20. To me, it is so obvious that that was error. And I also think, although this issue, as he points out, was not raised below, that you can't sit on a complaint, which is filed in 2006, for 3 years and not raise real parties in interest without, and then suddenly do it in 2009, 3 years later. Now, it is true that the complaint was amended, but the original complaint alleged malpractice against Lacey, fraud in the inducement, and a couple of other things against Rennick. And all those things were dismissed by Judge Ibarra because of Rule 17. Whether you call it standing or real parties in interest or whatever you want to call it, basically what his ruling was is the individual plaintiffs are not parties to this agreement, so therefore, Rule 17. Okay. That should have been raised
just
in the answer
record.
Or before the answer, or at least in the motion to amend the complaint.
But didn't he later clarify that he said they had no damages in
He makes his ruling, and it's a confusing ruling. It's in his order. It's attached to Exhibit A to the open brief. I'll read it to you. He says that not part of the answer is yes, Your Honor. And what I would argue is that that's exactly the same argument. There's no damages because they're not real parties in interest because there's no damages. I don't see any difference. To me, that's a clever way of trying to argue something different, which happened in the answering brief, in order to avoid the waiver. There's no difference between saying no damages and you know, not privity to the contract. And of course, we argue that privity to the contract's
What damage is different than the LLC do the individuals have?
Well, for one thing, the $378,000. I mean, LLC can't, arguably can't sue for that because they didn't give it to them. That was there, and the damages, the bankruptcy damages, whatever those were ultimately worth, the $300,000 invested. And literally everything in this complaint, the representation by Lacey was so obviously of these individuals. It wasn't of the LLC, which wasn't even created until the contract was signed in July of 2005. He was hired by Gordon, Mr. Lacey. And then he created this after the fact. His worksheets show Gordon as his client.
Now, assuming we even agree with you on the issue that they were clients, okay, assuming that, I want to go back to the issue of the damages, because okay. 378 is part of the consideration paid on behalf of the LLC.
No, stop right there. It's not paid on behalf of the LLC.
Well, but they're not parties to the purchase and sale agreement, so it's
That's
part
true.
Of consideration for the purchase, right?
Okay, point made. Sure. Yes.
And isn't the LLC claiming that as part of the fraudulent inducement, it was induced to buy this business, and that was part of the damages, the amount that they paid to
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so why isn't that duplicative of what the LLC is claiming?
Well, I'll tell you why. Because you get all these other counts dismissed if you dump the. Once you get rid of the individual plaintiffs, you have a really hard time with the issue of unfair and deceptive labor, unfair and deceptive trade practices, of conspiracy, of fraud. All those things collapse if it isn't an individual. If it's an LLC, then you have problems with it. All you have to do is look at the dismissal of the malpractice claim. It was dismissed because they're not real parties in interest.
Well, let me clarify that. In terms of the trial
okay.
that went forward, the claims were the LLC's claims at that point. Were all, at the point
yes.
of trial.
Yes.
All of the claims as to your individual plaintiffs, Mr. and Mrs. Playho, were dismissed.
That's correct.
Okay, either dismissed or summary judgment was entered, right?
That's right.
Okay, I know there was clarification and then a subsequent MSJ.
That's right.
But at that point at trial, the only standing plaintiff was the LLC.
That's right.
Okay. And so, and somewhere during the trial, fraud claims were dismissed under by judgment by the court. And so the trial, the jury only reached the question of malpractice.
That's correct.
Is that clear? Okay. So
yes.
That's the record in this case.
Yeah.
So what is your underlying premise in terms of what kind of damages could have been proven if your individual plaintiffs were still standing
well,
at that point?
Well, you know, this is a difficult thing to call. And basically, the position I took repeatedly was that an argument to a jury that there's fraud in the inducement against real-life human beings, individuals who are bankrupted and who are in trouble and who struggled to operate a business that was grossly overvalued is a far different thing than coming in on a single issue under 0.116 of the rules of professional misconduct. In other words, a technical violation for Lacey not telling them about the rule of sale. I mean, the jury was left with almost nothing, whereas all of the evidence involving the actual harm to these people was excluded both before because of the removal of the individuals, but just as importantly, the JMOL. The mid-trial JMOL could have kept this thing together, and it's a very bizarre ruling. Because the Lacey's lawyer did not argue that there was no evidence of fraud or fraud in the inducement. He argued there was no evidence of damages. He said, hey, we got this Cuba guy, and it's $1.25 million, and he's already gotten six, they're getting this free and clear because of the dismissal of the promissory note. They're meaning LLC. So therefore, there's no damages here. That's what he argued. And the judge, which, by the way, applied equally to fraud, the inducement, and malpractice, right? Those are the damages for all three. They were essentially you might argue, overlapped. The malpractice and the fraud and the inducement, the fraud all caused the same damages. So by dismissing just the fraud and the inducement, but keeping the malpractice, essentially Judge Barr rejected their argument about damages. And what he says is that there's insufficient evidence to show fraud or fraud and the inducement. To me, a review of Rennick's deposition, which was read 90% into the record, it is just appalling. It's true that the only surviving defendant is Lacey, but obviously the claim was that Lacey was integrally involved in this fraud and fraud and inducement. That really just makes no sense to me whatsoever, and it wasn't even argued by Lacey's counsel. He argued insufficient proof of damages. The judge turns around, ignores that argument, lets the malpractice go, and says somehow that this record, I'm obviously an advocate, but is appalling. I listed the things that Rennick and Lacey lied about: earnings, overhead, competition, shop lease, prior legal representation, prior offers, customer base, financial statements, and market value. A girl that used to work for Rennick testified at the trial. And she said, he literally turned to her and said, fix those financial statements so it looks like we have more profits. Park the cars in back so they'll think we're busy.
But ultimately, wasn't the problem that they ran the business, they had the books, they owned the cars, they were on premises for 7 months prior to the closing date, and they had a clause in the contract, Article 11.1, that allowed termination, a contract remedy, not fraud remedy, but a contract remedy to terminate prior to closing.
Yeah, that argument's made by Rennick. It is motion for summary judgment. It's not made by Lacey. It's not part of the trial. It's not even there.
Okay.
The only place it is in the motion for summary judgment. I would argue, as I did in my brief, that a provision in a contract for either arbitration or cancellation doesn't preclude you from filing a lawsuit for fraud. It doesn't preclude you from keeping the business for whatever reason, and basically claiming like they did it, a separate count, inadequate consideration. That's not a waiver of a fraud claim. All that says is that there's a remedy in that contract, but it's not exclusive.
Right,
I don't understand that.
But isn't the argument that there can be no reliance on the representations because the remedy was to get out of the deal, that you didn't rely on the representation because you were relying on your on-site ownership and operation?
I'm not sure I follow that, but I will say that there's an argument on reliance, a very strong argument on reliance, in Rennick's motion for summary judgment. Again, we're getting away from Lacey, but that motion claimed that issue was waived in Gordon's depo. That was all that argument. That was the only reliance argument. In the depo, they said, well, did you buy all this stuff Rennick told you? And at some point, Gordon said, No, I wanted to check it out with Lacey. If Lacey hadn't confirmed it, I wouldn't have believed it. So, aha, Rennick jumps up. So you didn't. And he was questioned further by his counsel.
But the reliance evidence was in the contract itself, which was already in as part of that motion, correct?
I'm not sure I
followed that. The unreasonableness of the reliance is that you have a contract remedy if you think there are misrepresentations made, and therefore it's unreasonable to rely on misrepresentations when you have a contract remedy that allows you to get out of the contract if you believe misrepresentations were made.
But the only way you can exercise that contract remedy is if you establish that Rennick misrepresented himself. He doesn't just back out for fun. The only way he can back out of that thing before the PUC transfers is if there's proof of misrepresentation, the same proof that he puts on in a fraud case. And of course, you really think Rennick's going to say, oh, you're right, here's your properties back? No, he's going to say, sue me. They would have litigated that provision if it had gone to court, because the only way they could get out of the contract was if they established, if either the PUC did not transfer, I think that was another tripping thing. And the other thing was, yeah, that if his representations about the value were fraudulent, exact same thing that they sued on. And my concern is, if you look at the motion for summary judgment, there's no authority whatsoever that says a provision in a contract that says you can change your mind 8 months later is a bar to suing for fraud. I mean, keeping the place rather than doing a rescission. He didn't sue for rescission. And there isn't any obligation for him to do that. He's
I don't think
to
it's
keep
a,
the place and sue for fraud and fraud.
I don't think it's a bar. I think the trouble that is evident is the reliance part of on whether they're relying on the statements or not. It's not a matter of bar. So in terms of, you know, the statements, one of the things that comes to mind when I'm hearing you speak is there was a letter by Maria,
right,
insisting that they go forward with the transaction.
Yes,
right? How do you deal with that?
Is that you rip this off and all the vehicles don't run, and I mean, to me that letter is prima facie that she not only was understood that the vehicles were in good shape, but that they weren't. No, I would argue that, and you're leaving out this one little factor as well, which is that the reason, and Gordon testified about this at trial, the reason he didn't go to Reddick and shut the deal down is because of Lacey. Lacey said, cool it, let the license transfer first, then you can. That's what Lacey advised him to do. Part of the reason when counsel found out about that communication, that's when he alleged conspiracy and brought in Lacey and charged him with all the same offenses. Because clearly, Lacey is the one who advised him not to. Now, Lacey was asked at the trial as to whether or not he advised him that way. He denied it and then said he didn't remember. But Gordon testified that he did. That's evidence. That's evidence that if he didn't take advantage of that waiver, which again, I argue is not a waiver, but to the extent he didn't take advantage of that remedy, it was because Lacey advised him not to. My time's up, so. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Hiroka?
Thank you, Chief Judge Nakamura, Judge Leonard, Judge Lisa. I'm Keith Hiroka, and I represent David Lacey and his former law firm, Lacey & Jackson. There are two significant aspects of the case that I'd like to address right at the beginning. The first is that this is an appeal from a final judgment based on a jury verdict where there was no error in the trial. There was no appeal from jury selection, no appeal from opening statement, no appeal from evidentiary rulings, no appeal from closing arguments, no appeal from jury instructions, no appeal from the special verdict form.
But appeal from the directed verdict.
Appeal from the directed verdict, but for the issues that were tried, there was no error. And so the jury found that my client breached the standard of care, but the jury found that breach was not the legal cause of any damage to the LLC.
Mr. Hiroka, part of what Mr. Esser is arguing is that the individual plaintiffs should have been at that trial as well. Now, assuming that is the case, and I know you would argue otherwise, but assuming that is the case, is there collateral estoppel? What is the impact of the jury's verdict as to no damages on individual claims? Is there any?
Well, Your Honor, the jury didn't find no damages. The jury found no legal causation. And so the jury didn't even have to reach the issue of whether or not there were damages.
Would the no causation verdict impact the individual claims?
They would be collaterally estopped because they're in privity with the LLC that was the party to the action. And that's actually the second point that I wanted to stress, Your Honor, is that it is uncontroverted what the relationships between the plaintiffs and the plaintiffs in Dragon Ernick were in this case. The second amended complaint is very carefully drafted, and it never alleges that Goran Plejo or Ana Maria Plejo are liable for the purchase price, are liable for the note, or have any obligation, incurred any obligation to Dragon Ernick.
Mr. Hiroki, even if we agree with you on that point as to the fraud, isn't there a distinction between the fraud and the malpractice claims, though? I mean, isn't the malpractice as to the individuals slightly different than malpractice as to the LLC?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because the malpractice that was alleged was that my client failed to disclose to his client that he represented Don Rulo in a transaction where Mr. Rulo was proposing to purchase the limousine business for $800,000 in cash. And apparently the jury agreed that that was a breach and that he shouldn't disclose it. But the jury also, and if he should have disclosed it, he should have disclosed it to the LLC as well as to the Playhos if the Playhos were his clients.
So but it was the sole malpractice claim was the failure to disclose.
That's the breach. That was the breach that the claim was based on.
What is the jury's finding of no causation? What does that mean versus no damage? What's the no causation if it's separate from no damage?
Well, Your Honor, based on the evidence that was introduced at trial, I think the only thing that the jury could have based that verdict on was a finding that the Ernick transaction was not a material fact that would have been considered by the buyer.
So basically the buyers would have gone through with the deal anyway?
Yes, based on what they knew at the time. And the reason for that and what I argued to the jury is that it was a different deal. Don Rulo had $800,000 in cash that he was going to pay up front to buy the company. It wasn't contingent on anything. And Ernick would have taken that cash. He didn't have to worry about future payments. Goren Playho, LLC, did not have the wherewithal. There was testimony at trial that Mr. Playho actually tried to get a loan to finance the purchase, but he was turned down because he didn't have collateral.
Did you argue that because of the settlement, there's no causation? In other words, because he already got paid off the $650 in effect, that there was no causation for the malpractice?
I believe I argued that on the motion for judgment as a matter of law. I can't remember. I don't believe I argued it in closing argument, Your Honor. I read the argument last night, and I don't think I mentioned that in the closing.
If I could turn your attention to Mr. Esser's arguments about the individuals being dismissed early on in this case as to, or their claims as to your client, I should say, were dismissed fairly early on in this case. And the clarification order says that the dismissal was granted in part, well, because there were no damage. The individuals did not suffer damages. And Mr. Esser argues here that there were individual damages, that they put up cash from their accounts, et cetera. How do you address that?
Legally, Your Honor, because the Second Amended Complaint and all of the evidence was that the only party that was indebted to the seller is the LLC. Now, the LLC was a sole member manager LLC. It was Goren Playho. Ana Maria Playho was not a member of the LLC. They put three properties down, and in answer to Judge Leonard's question, the Second Amendment complaint, paragraph 28, does allege that the Playhos owned the Las Vegas properties as his junior wife.
It does allege that, but is there any evidence in the record to support that?
Your Honor, I believe that the property report, the title reports for the Las Vegas properties are in the record. I can't remember where they are.
But you would you're stipulating that the properties were owned by both?
I cannot stipulate, Your Honor, because I don't remember.
Okay.
But I know that that is what was alleged in the complaint.
Right.
Now, even if that had been, if that was true, what they did was they became creditors of the LLC by advancing those funds, or that might have been Mr. Playho's investment and Ms. Playho's, or Mr. Playho's contribution and Ms. Playho's investment or loan.
Well, Mr. Hiroka, certainly that would have limited a breach of contract claim or any sort of contract claim, but we have tort claims here saying it was fraud. and I relied on what was going on in this transaction and contributed based on your misrepresentations, right?
Then the Playhos would have claims against the LLC. Mrs. Playho would have a claim against her husband as the decision-making sole member of the LLC for inducing that investment.
So does Mrs. Playho allege that Mr. Lacey made any representations to her directly or indirectly?
The Second Amendment complaint does allege that Mr. Lacey represented that it was a good deal to that effect. The Second Amendment complaint does make those allegations.
Right.
But again, Your Honor, the jury verdict moots those claims because her claim would be derivative. If anything, her claim is that the LLC owes me $378,000 or my interest in these three properties that was down. And now I can't collect it from the LLC because it wasn't what the seller and the lawyer represented it to be. So I threw all this money into a bad investment. I can't get my money back from the LLC that owes it to me.
Well, that's one theory, though, but is that the only theory?
I can't think of any other theory.
Well, let me go backwards. So the fact that your client was the lawyer for the LLC doesn't mean he couldn't also have been the lawyer for the individuals, does it?
It does not.
Right. Correct. So assuming that he was their lawyer and he provided incorrect information to them, causing them to invest their personal assets in this transaction, why wouldn't they have a claim for damages based upon that alone? Your argument is, well, they could go get it from the LLC, maybe. But why wouldn't they be able to get it from a malpracticing lawyer in my scenario?
Because the evidence was, Your Honor, that term, that the three Las Vegas properties would be the down payment, and that the value of the properties was agreed to be $378,000, was agreed upon between Mr. Playho and Mr. Koenig before they even came to see Mr. Lacey. That was the evidence at trial. The evidence was that Mr. Playho and Mr. Lacey, who spoke the same language, were from the same country, and played soccer together. And Mr. Playho had represented Mr. Ernick as realtor in purchase of property. So these were two men who had a prior relationship. They had all the deal terms down before they came to see Mr. Lacey because they needed a lawyer to do the documentation.
But Mr. Esser just argued that they would have gotten out of the deal but for Mr. Lacey's telling them, no, you got to go forward.
That's argument, Your Honor.
He said it was testimony at trial.
Well, the testimony at trial by Mr. Playho was that Mr. Lacey said, wait. But the evidence that the jury apparently believed, because it was testified to by Mr. Lacey and it was shown in the absence of documents, is that Mr. Playho is actually really smart. Mr. Playho didn't say anything to Mr. Lacey about misrepresentation, misdescription of the value of the company or the assets, the condition of the assets, until after the PUC license transferred. And then he was only making claims against Mr. Ernick because he didn't want to pay the balance of the promissory note. The evidence at trial was that Mr. Playho never complained to Mr. Lacey that Mr. Lacey had misrepresented anything to him until after, way after, the PUC license transferred. And the reason I say Mr. Playho is very smart, Your Honor, is because once the PUC license transferred, the company had no value to Mr. Ernick anymore, no matter what happened. Because Mr. Ernick, even if he took back all the assets, all of the limousines, the office lease, the furniture, fixtures, equipment, Mr. Ernie could not operate that company because the PUC license belonged to the LLC. The LLC was the only entity that could legally operate. And so once Mr. Playho was able to get the PUC license transferred, he was holding all the cards. And once he was holding all the cards is when he stopped making payments. When he started complaining about, oh, this is what you sold me was not what I thought I was buying. He was a very calculated decision on his part. And Your Honor, that was the evidence that the jury believed. The other evidence that the jury heard was that.
But aren't those all tribal issues? So does that count in terms of whether the court was right in granting summary judgment prior to trial and dismissing the claims before trial?
Your Honor, even if the court erred in dismissing those claims before the trial, and I'm not conceding it did, but even if the court had erred, the jury verdict cured the error. Because there was nothing that the individual plaintiffs claimed Mr. Lacey did or didn't do that was any different than what the LLC claimed Mr. Lacey did or didn't do.
What doctrine is that? Is there something like subsequent cure of the error? Is that a legally recognized?
I think it would be collateral estoppel or res judicata, Your Honor, because like I said, the plaintiffs were in privity. The contract was between the LLC and Ernick.
Didn't the individuals also have claims for IIED and IED and Chapter 480 claims?
Yes, they did, Your Honor.
And those wouldn't have anything to do with the being in privity, would they?
No, Your Honor, but the basis for those claims would have been, again, Mr. Lacey failing to disclose that he had represented Don Rulo and what the Rulo transaction terms would have been. And the jury found, again, that didn't cause any harm to the LLC, so it couldn't have caused any harm to the individuals. And I think Chief Judge Nakamura started out by asking if that's collateral estoppel, and I think that's either issue preclusion or claim preclusion or some kind of preclusion because it's the jury's verdict. It was the jury's finding and there's no error with it.
Mr. Hiroka, one of the things that Mr. Esser argues is that at trial they could have put forward other evidence if the individuals were still parties to the case. What was there any ruling as to inadmissibility of evidence because of who the parties were at that point?
I cannot think of any, Your Honor. And it would, in fact, have been the same evidence because Mr. Playho testified at trial. He was the sole member of the LLC. He was the guy running the ship. So anything that they would have said individually would have been through Mr. Playho, and he testified at trial. He wasn't prevented from testifying. I did want to address the cross-appeal, Your Honor, and I acknowledge that the plaintiff is right. I did not object at trial based on the bankruptcy schedules, based on the failure to disclose the LLC's debt to the Playhos in the bankruptcy schedules. And I did not try to impeach Mr. Playho by asking him about his failure to disclose the debt that the LLC owed him for the advance on the bankruptcy schedules. But however, some things are so fundamentally wrong that a court should deal very firmly with the transgressing party. And this is one of those circumstances. And I'm just gonna cite to the Marable case that was decided a couple of months ago by the 11th Circuit. Failing to disclose assets by a debtor in bankruptcy is so fundamentally wrong that the debtor should not be allowed to benefit by making that the basis of a subsequent civil claim.
But the LLC wasn't the debtor.
That's right. The LLC was not the debtor. But
so how is the LLC estopped?
The LLC is estopped because Mr. Playho would have been estopped from collecting the debt from the LLC. Now remember, the Playhos invested 378, the three properties. plus cash that they advanced to the LLC, and that was their claim. Well, the LLC is a debtor to them. The LLC owes them that money back. In bankruptcy, their trustee could have gone to the LLC and tried to get that money in through an adversary proceeding, but the trustee didn't because they never disclosed it on the schedules. And so if the LLC had recovered that money from my clients, then that money would not have gone to creditors in the bankruptcy because that asset was never scheduled. They would have defrauded their creditors by not disclosing that asset on their bankruptcy schedules. And that is so fundamentally wrong that the court should not have allowed the LLC to benefit from that by not having to fork that money over to the trustee.
We reach that issue only if there is another trial, obviously.
Yes. Yes. I'd like to defer to Mr. Klein on his appeal.
Thank you.
Mr. Klein.
Good morning, Chief Judge, members of the court. May it please the court. Robert Klein representing Dragan Renick. I believe that's how he pronounces his name. It's unclear to me. Just to touch on some of the questions that the court raised before, one of the issues was with respect to the sale of assets agreement as to whether or not Goren and Anna Maria actually agreed to transfer the properties and therefore whether they have standing. You know, it's clearly recited in the sales agreement that at 1.2a, that Goren certainly states that as principal of buyer being the LLC, that he would transfer the three Las Vegas properties. So he certainly purported to have the authority to transfer the properties as consideration for the purchase agreement of the assets. And I think there's no reference that we know of to who actually were the owners of the property, whether both Anna Maria or Goren was, but he certainly agreed to and represented that he would on behalf of the LLC. And I think that's kind of the way they operated the LLC. He made the decisions. And he's a prominent player. I think the court is right to focus on the settlement agreement with respect to their Renick issues in this case. The settlement agreement that was put on the record on March 10th, 2011, it is exceedingly clear. Often when you're in a settlement situation and you have your client on the phone, as Mr. Rosdell did, there's going to be an interplay between the court, the attorney, and the client. And in here, all three parties, the court, the client, the attorney, as well as Mr. Claggett, who was there. It's clear if you read the transcript of the settlement that there's a meeting of the minds. The intention is to resolve all the issues between all the parties and put this whole mess behind them.
How do you address this literal argument that as to the $100,000 payment, the only representation made by the plaintiff was that Mr. Goren was going to pay that?
Well, I think that's sort of the tail wagging the dog, to be honest with you, Your Honor. But it's part of the agreement. And I think there was a meeting of the minds. I mean, there was a meeting of the minds to settle all of this and to pay $100,000 to resolve all issues individually, probably. I don't know. I can't say for certain. I wasn't there. But with respect to the issues, I don't think you can stand silent in a settlement conference when the items of settlement, everything that's going to be resolved in detail, are put on the record, and then later say, well, it wasn't binding. I don't think you can say that. I think you have an obligation to speak up. Mr. Rosdell should have spoken up if there was something missing, or Mr. Plano should have spoken up and said that there was something missing. I think all items were put on the record aside from what you mentioned, Your Honor, but the major issues were put on the record between the parties. And when we talk about the right to appeal, remember, if you review the settlement agreement carefully, the court states in the settlement agreement, now on both settlements between Ernick the Lacey defendants as well as Mr. Rosdell's clients any objections. If there's any dispute as to the terms of the settlement, that this court is the final binding arbiter, no appeal, question mark, question mark. What does Mr. Rosdell say? That's correct. But he agrees that the court's going to be the final binding arbiter of any disputes having to do with the settlement agreement. So why are we here discussing the settlement agreement when it should be before Judge Ibarra? Mr. Rosdell was, every attorney there, all three, Claggett, Rosdell, Hiroka, all agreed that, Judge, we trust you to resolve all disputes with respect to the settlement agreement, all disputes. So there is no intention that appeal would be taken on the basis of an unenforceable settlement agreement. That would have to be something that went back to Judge Ibarra.
Mr. Klein, if I could, assuming that the appeal is before us properly, in terms of the LLC's liability for paying the $100,000, and just understanding the circumstances, the totality of the circumstances at that point, was the bankruptcy as to the individual Playhos still pending at the time that this settlement was put on the record in March of 2011, if you know?
I don't think so. I can't honestly answer that, but I doubt it.
I know that there was a lifting of the stay so that they could pursue their claims in this case, but perhaps Mr. Esser can address that.
It was.
Is that correct?
Okay, thank you.
And I'd like to address the issue of fraud. I think Judge Leonard was on the right track talking about reliance. I mean, first of all, my client was not committing fraud. Mr. Playho basically said, I'm going to trust this agreement to my attorney, whatever my attorney says. He testified at his deposition in that fashion. So he didn't rely on my client's representations to begin with. He just deferred to his attorney. That's what he stated in his deposition. Furthermore, he knew about the alleged misrepresentations. He was stretching this out to the point where he could get the PUC license that made this company valuable. He wasn't about to give up. He wasn't about to raise issues of, quote, misrepresentation or fraud prior to obtaining the PUC license. In the meantime, he pocketed almost $380,000. He bought new cars. And he was completely familiar with the deal that he got into, and he tactically didn't raise the issues, and his remedies were limited under the agreement, as was discussed here. He specifically agreed to limit his remedies. The LLC's contractual remedy was to terminate the agreement and cancel the sale, rescind it, and he agreed to that. So bringing subsidiary claims or claims afterwards are certainly not a remedy that he had, even though Mr. Esser says, well, he's had all these other remedies. You can agree to limit your remedies in a contract, and he did. Unless the court has any other questions.
You know, Mr. Klein, mm-hmm. just to clarify on the $100,000 issue, what is your position as to what the court's ruling should be? Are you saying that we should simply say it's enforceable against Goran individually, or are you arguing that the settlement, the $100,000 payment should be enforced against the LLC and Goran based on the record we have?
Well, I think it should be enforced against both, Your Honor, as you suggest, because I think if you look at this record carefully, Goran is the LLC, frankly. And if he agrees to bind the LLC as he did in the sale of assets agreement, that's clear proof that he's purporting to be the clear manager of the LLC.
You think that's the context of the discussion?
I believe so, Your Honor. And I don't think it's disputed. I don't see anything Anna Maria saying that he didn't have the right to do that. She certainly could have claims against the LLC or against her husband, but I don't see that in the record.
I do have one question that's similar to what I asked Mr. Esser, which is that if you assume that the settlement put on the record is enforceable, I take it as your position that all claims, obviously, by and against your client, Mr. Rinnick, are done?
Yes.
And in terms of Mr. Lacey, so that all of your claims as to Mr. Lacey are done, Pau.
Correct.
And did the settlements include both individual plaintiffs as well, specifically?
I think that was the intent of the settlement. When you say all claims against all parties, I mean, how many different ways can you say it, Your Honor? Everybody knew who was involved in this case.
And I
think the judge took it that way.
And then ultimately that went to trial is just the LLC's claims vis-a-vis Mr. Lacey and his law firm.
Yes.
Okay.
But Maria is not, the court ultimately didn't include Maria in the settlement. True?
True.
So if so Maria's claims are not extinguished by the settlement, they would have to be extinguished by the court's prior orders dismissing her out of the case individually.
I think it's a murky area, Your Honor. I think we can sit back here today and, you know, play Monday morning quarterback. But I think the court, in the settlement agreement, if you look at what Judge Ibarra was trying to do, he was trying to eliminate all claims against all parties and make it final. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think my time's all used up.
All right.
Sir, just because you weren't on the mic when you clarified my question to
I'm sorry. Yes, the bankruptcy was a temporary stay back to the circuit court to try these issues, and it listed the claims in the schedule, both by Rennick and by Lacey, because there were counterclaims and cross-claims.
Just specifically, all I wanted to clarify was at the time that the settlement was put on the record in March of 2011, your individual client's bankruptcy was still pending.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. I want to refer to the deposition of Gorin and this whole issue of reliance, because it's sort of mixed in, especially with your questions, Judge Leonard, about the issue of the PUC transfer in that 7-month period and reliance and the whole thing about reliance. So it's important to note, this is a December 2008 depo, and we don't know why summary judgment was granted, because the judge didn't say, and frequently judges don't say, but they cite one page in this depo, and what happened is we filed an opposition and we attached big chunks to the depo, and there are all kinds of statements that make clear that he was relying on both. And in fact, in one case, at page 178, he is asked by Mr. Claggett, let's see. Okay, so you didn't really rely on what Dragon Rennick gave you, did you? Well, I relied on it too. This is after he said he wasn't going to buy any of it unless Lacey confirmed it. So he said too. This is page 178. This is attached to the opposition. But 120, he's asked, besides the condition of the cars, the financials, the client list, and the competition issues, are there any other misrepresentations you believe the Dragon made to you that induced you in entering into the contract? That's the question asked by Claggett. The answer is yes. And then he lists a few more. It's clearly vague in this depo as to who he blames the most. But I think what Gorin was trying to do is say, you're not going to blame this all on Rennick, because Lacey was my lawyer, and A, he should have advised me, and B, he actually told me it was a $1.5 million company.
Now, with respect to Maria only, what's her claim of attorney-client relationship and malpractice?
She appeared with him at the first meeting with Lacey. She appeared several times with Rennick. The problem with...
What's the indication on her part that Lacey was going to act as her lawyer?
She's listed on the client sheets. Gorin and Anna Marie. I think after the initial meetings, it was probably mostly Gorin, because they lived and operated in Las Vegas, and he flew over alone most of the time.
And with respect to her fraud claim against Rennick, what's the basis for her claim as to that?
Well, we have two sub-issues. One is that she doesn't, as far as I know, speak Serbian. So if they were conversing in Serbian, which they frequently did, they meeting Gorin and Dragon, then she couldn't understand it. And of course, what I argue in the opening brief is, obviously Gorin would say, this is what he told me, And part of what I cite to establish that is this letter we keep referring to. That letter, by the way, was he indicates that all of the complaints were after the POC transferred. That letter was long before the POC transferred.
So you don't dispute that there's no direct communication between Lacey and Maria?
Oh, I do dispute
or
that.
Or direct misrepresentation between the two of them, the jury.
Yes. Well, I'm talking about the case of Renick. In Renick's case, if it was in Serbian, she couldn't understand it. And clearly, most of the time, it was Gordon.
All right, so let me go back. So what's the representation from Renick to Maria that you claim is fraudulent?
Oh, that it was communicated to her through Gordon. And that she relied on it because she was co-owners of the property, and it's her finances.
Does that count? Does the representation made by a third party, an intermediary, does that?
Sure. I mean, I would say
because,
that.
Because why?
Well, first of all, their lawyer is advising both of them. They both own the Las Vegas properties that were transferred. You just focused on the $378,000 alone. Also, if you look at Anna's letter, Anna says essentially to Renick, you told us these vehicles were, there were going to be 24 vehicles and they were in good shape. Actually, there's only 10 and they're falling apart. That shows her understanding. I'm sorry?
Right, but the you told us is you told my husband because that's what the husband told her, he said.
Well, assuming that, because Renick obviously spoke both English and Serbian, but to the extent they raised this issue of, hey, a lot of the discussions were in Serbian and she couldn't understand, they're communicated to her by her husband.
But how does that count? Is the husband isn't Renick's agent, is he?
If they both own the property and she's making a sizable investment, the husband says, this is what Renick told me. And by the way, in Renick's depo, he acknowledges he gave them false financial statements. He acknowledges misrepresentations, and he also acknowledges that he was represented by Lacey before. It wasn't just the Rolo thing that was the issue of malpractice. It was also that Lacey had represented Renick before, and that Addie Bowman testified that you have to disclose that. But
all right, your time's up, Mr. Esser. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
We'll take the case under advisement.